Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. This has really been wonderful being here this week with all of you and Reverend Master Jiu. I wanted to talk today about living in the world as if in the sky, lay training. A few weeks ago, I was fortunate enough to be able to spend some time on the Oregon coast. And the ocean has always drawn me. I find that whenever I go, something there speaks to me. Sometimes it's the waves, sometimes it's the tide pools. This time it was the seagulls. There were some sand dunes with big seagrasses, you know, growing on the top. And the seagulls would just come sailing over. And they would either fly along the waves or just down the coast. They would sometimes flap their wings and then they would just be carried. You know, they would just be sailing in the air currents. And I found myself watching them for hours. There was something so incredibly peaceful about it, and something so nourishing that I would just, you know, I could just sort of gave myself over to it. And I realized this week what it was about that I was being shown how that which is greater than ourselves just holds all of us, just holds everything, you know, just holds us. And within that we can rest and we can be at ease. And as I was listening this week to monks' experiences and some of your experiences with Reverend Master Jiu, I saw that this is what she manifested in her person, this benevolence, this generosity, this being able to hold everything, and that she, in herself, was at ease with that. And the great gift that she gave to us was holding out her faith to all of us that we could find that same place within us and that we could rest there and be at ease there. And it wasn't so much because, you know, she knew us, because she had this faith in every being. This was the Buddha's teaching. Every being, everything has Buddha nature. And there was never any question in her mind about it. There was never any doubt. This is what we saw. The absence of doubt, you know, the certainty that she had. And she was always encouraging us to really take the practice, work with it, prove it for ourselves. And so some of the things that I'm going to be talking about today are ways that she offered those who chose the path of the householder or the lay trainee. She just, you know, she writes a lot about it in The Roar of the Tigress, but I want to just read a few sentences here. She says, every single person, whether she or he is in a monastery or outside of it, can get to the cosmic Buddha. They're going to go by a different road, but they're still going to get there. One is not going to get something different from the other. One may get there faster than the other because they're at it full time, in quotes, but the place they're going to is going to be identically the same one. So there is not a heaven for the monks and a heaven for the lay people. It's just how long you are going to take and which road you're going to go by. She used these words. She used to talk about getting to the cosmic Buddha or finding the eternal or getting there, you know, with a capital T. She talked about the Lord of the house. She talked about Buddha nature. You know, she said, doesn't matter where you, what you call it, he, she, it. Buddha nature doesn't care what you call it. One day she said, you could call it the great haystack. She was trying to make a point. And I remember during the 70s, or perhaps a bit later, there was a period of time where the legal courts were becoming the vehicle for people to work out their personal issues with one another, and everybody began suing one another. If you recall, maybe we've kind of gotten a little more used to it, but at the time it was really quite shocking. Parents started suing children, children were suing parents, teachers suing students, husbands suing wives, wives suing husbands. And she said, you know, what lies behind this is a great sense of entitlement. Entitlement. We are entitled to something, and if we don't get it, we're going to sue for it. She said, actually, she said, the only thing that we are all entitled to is the realization of our Buddha nature. She said, but you know, not many people are interested in that because it's a lot of work. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. Some of the work that's involved and some of her teaching about it. As some of you know, I was a lay trainee for many years before I became a monk. For about 12 years, I met Reverend Master Jiyu in Berkeley in 1973, and I was ordained in 1985. So I found a great joy in training, in lay training, and I never got over the marvel of how it is possible to train in any condition, in any situation, no matter where you are, no matter who you are, no matter what is going on in your life. Something about this has always filled me with wonder, and it continues to do so. And when I became a monk, it was not because I had not found what I needed as a lay trainee. I continued as a lay trainee because I wanted to prove to myself that the practice could be done completely and fully as a householder. And I found that true for myself and for so many people that I was training with, and so many of you who are continuing on the path. So, and it was actually, of course, it was Reverend Master Jiyu's teaching that brought all of this alive. I want to tell you something about how I met her, because that teaching in itself, how I met her was really bringing to life one of her teachings, which is that the very thing you have the hardest time with, what you think of as your koan or your spiritual problem, is also your doorway in. All right? It is your doorway in to the eternal. And I certainly proved that true for myself in the following way. I had a terrific problem with boredom. And this had to do with being bored with daily life. You know, just simply ordinary daily life. I had a terrifically difficult time doing things like, you know, housework, grocery shopping, balancing my checkbook, the most ordinary details of daily life, because I was preoccupied with the idea there was something more important that I should be doing. I never knew what it was. And partly I got a little bit derailed by the search for the exotic. And as we used to say back then, the far out. That was the operative word. Some of you old-timers may remember. If it was far out, it was great. So, you know, this was... I was living in the Bay Area in the 60s and 70s, and I can tell you there was a lot of far out going on. I made my way through a lot of it, but I became very interested in meditation and wanted to find out about Zen meditation. And part of the fascination for me was that it was a different culture, and that is, I started meditating with the group that was Japanese, from the Japanese tradition, and there was a lot of the Japanese language was used. I didn't understand a lot of what was going on, which added to my sense of it being unusual and exotic. It was just what I needed, you know. And also, my seeing rooms full of people sitting and looking at a wall, I thought, this is so incredibly boring. You know, I was fascinated by it. And I was drawn to it because what in the world could these people be doing? And the thing of it was, there were a lot of them. They were getting up at maybe 4:30 in the morning to do it at 5 o'clock before they went to work. Some of them were wearing business suits and, you know, dress for business. The women left their high heels outside. And so here were people, there were so many, that they had to have two sittings. I think there was maybe one at 5:30 and one at 6. And so I thought, gosh, there's really something going on here, but I don't really know what it is. I had meditation instruction, and I struggled with the meditation for about a year, during which time my life began to really kind of fall apart. I was going through a divorce. I found that the work that I had been training myself for was completely unsuited to. My mother was dying, and I really kind of didn't know what was going to be the next step. So I went up on the Oregon coast and stayed there for a while, and a friend who had been meditating with me wrote me a letter, and she said, "I have been taking a class at UC from a female Roshi." She said, "When you get back, I will take you. I think you'll like her." So we went to UC where she was giving classes, and I remember that when I first saw her, I was just struck by her appearance. This large woman with a British accent, a shaved head, which was completely unusual back then, and wearing a robe and speaking with great certainty. And I probably sat there for about half an hour just kind of taking in her presence, if you know what I mean. And then I started actually listening to what she was saying. And when it was over, I said, well, when is she coming back? She talked about many things. I remember she talked about finding the Buddha nature, Buddha nature being everywhere in everything, finding the Buddha nature. And she talked about the all is one and the all is different. And I began really to understand many, many things that had puzzled me all my life. And she talked about the fact that we are all completely different. We all have different backgrounds. We have different ethnic backgrounds. We come from different religious backgrounds. We have different education, male, female. Our genetic backgrounds are different. Our psychological backgrounds, our karmic history. Each of us is completely unique. So how in the world can we possibly be comparing ourselves to others? Which is really, for us, such a complete shift to how we think about ourselves and our place in the world and our society. We are so used to comparing ourselves, competing, and setting up our own standards. And so this was a complete shift. She really treasured the differences and the uniqueness in beings. And she had a way of addressing them and talking to people that acknowledged their differences and the great respect with which she treated people in her classes and the attention that she gave questions. She treated all questions as spiritual questions, whether they were the most practical or, you know, she would, how shall I say, she always took them at their deepest level. And she could use anything to teach. You know, the Buddha said, Buddha told his monks to use the idiom of wherever they were going so that the people they were talking to would understand them. And she had a wonderful facility for doing this. So, you know, this was during the 70s. People were talking about their astrological signs all the time. People would go up and to one another and say, well, you know, what's your sign? So she was teaching us about greed, hate, and delusion. So she would talk about, you know, you could ask me what my sign was. I'd say, well, I'm greed with delusion rising. But she had this perfectly wonderful sense of humor. You know, there was nothing that anybody could say that would be shocking or there was no possibility of there being a holy and a profane. Now, I don't know if some of you may remember, there was a lot of counterculture cartoons and, you know, magazines and newspapers and stuff around. There was one cartoon character called Mr. Natural. Mr. Natural. And I'm not sure she knew the origin of the entire comic strip. It was just as well that she didn't. But the thing is, Mr. Natural turned up in a... He would be wearing overalls. He was an old man. He had overalls and white hair and a very long beard, and he'd be wearing these boots. And the caption under the cartoon was, "Keep on truckin'." Somebody brought her a picture of Mr. Natural, and she said, "Great." She said, "That's a great Buddhist expression, keep on truckin'." So, you know, see, there wasn't any place to hide. You could not get away from it. Wherever she was, wherever it was everywhere. There was nothing that she could not use to teach. One of our monks who, before she became a monk, was married and had a family, and she told me that she had a daughter, and she told me that she said to her husband, "There's no way we're going to have any Barbie dolls in the house." And he had to come home one day and say, "You know, Reverend Master was using Barbie dolls as a teaching device, because one of the things that Reverend Master liked, a way that she had of relaxing, was she loved dollhouses, and she would have the monks make doll furniture and doll clothing. Remember, her father was a tailor, so she could give direction in making all kinds of doll clothes. Some of you may remember seeing an enormous dollhouse in the dining hall. And what she did with the Barbie dolls was she had some of the monks make a small dwelling, a small kind of a building, looked like a priory. And then she had Barbie and Ken dressing up as monks. Yeah. And she had them in different rooms of the priory, and she was teaching about various aspects of priory life and how you would furnish a priory and where the altar was. And, you know, so there they were. It was also a way that she had of bringing the monks together to work out something, you know. And believe you me, there was a lot of mental protest, I think, about working with dolls, about having to go to Toys R Us. I think it was Reverend Master Dysewe who actually purchased some of the Barbie dolls. Forgive me if it wasn't you, Reverend Master Dysewe, but that's my record. And so all of this, but you see, this was her way of helping us to get out of the usual ways of thinking about things. You know how we recite in the scripture, "All things herein have inherent great potentiality." I always think of Reverend Master with that, because she was constantly pointing to the great potentiality in all things. And of course, she saw things always that we didn't see. You know, you've heard us talk about watching television with her. We would be watching, and Perry Mason was a great favorite. She loved detective stories because she used to say, you know, you can train yourself to become a karmic detective, and you can look for clues in your daily life, you know. So we would be sitting watching a Perry Mason, and she would be sitting over in her chair, and maybe we would think she was dozing, and all of a sudden, she would make some comment, you know, offer some teaching on some scene that was going on in the Perry Mason film. So those of us who had hoped we left TV behind when we came into monastic life had some real training in learning to sit still with television and to see the teaching in it, to see what was constantly being offered. And it helped her also to see what people were thinking about and, you know, what was going on, help her sort of keep up with what was going on, because that was a means she had of talking to people in the idiom, so that people felt that she knew what they were talking about. And I'll tell you, she did. Now, one of the really profound changes that came about in my life as a householder had to do with Reverend Master's teaching about work. One day she said, "All work is the work of the Buddha, if it benefits beings." And I can still see her. I can just picture her saying that. Because it had such an effect on me. You know, here we are in our culture. So we are very much concerned about, again, about competition, about credentials, about status, about fame and gain and reputation, about achievement. And this is something that she tried really to help us with, because of course from the Buddhist point of view, as she said, all work is the work of the Buddha. And she had a way then of giving dignity and respect to everything that people were doing. And it gave a whole new face to doing housework. You know, this was during the 70s, so the women's movement was very much happening, and housekeeping was getting a lot of bad press. And, you know, so I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing to look at there, because you hear so much in Buddhist monasteries about the years that are spent in hauling water and chopping wood and, you know, cooking and cleaning the toilets. So that was an interesting perspective to bring to what was being talked about. She talked about, you know, taking out the garbage, washing out the baby's diapers, grocery shopping, all of these things. This is all the work of the Buddha. And for myself, I was having a very difficult time on my job. I had recently been hired on a job. When I think back on it, I had an incredible amount of chutzpah. You know, I just don't even know how, you know, it's the kind of thing you look back on and it's embarrassing, but, you know, it was good because I learned an awful lot. So I came on this job, I had a lot of opinions about how things should be done. I didn't get along with the boss. I didn't get along with any of my supervisors. I actually asked for a different one. And they told me, in no uncertain terms, that I had about 6 months to get my act together, or I could look for a different job. So they put me on probation. And during this time, I had begun to hear Reverend Master's lectures at UC. I didn't have enough nerve myself to ask a question, but happily enough, somebody was there who asked my question. This is why we always encourage you, have the courage to ask a question, because it will help not only you but many, many other people there. This man saved my life. He said, I'm having a lot of trouble with my boss. Do you have any advice for me? And she said, well, she said, your boss has the Buddha nature. And that just struck me like a bolt of lightning. Now, if that's true, then I need to change my behavior toward him. And I need to see him differently. Not wait for him to show me something so I can say, gee, he's got Buddha nature, you know? So the ball was in my court. And I actually looked at him through fresh eyes, and I saw the difficulties and the pressures that he was under, and I became much more sympathetic to what he was doing. And it was the beginning of really turning around this situation at work. So I was there, you know, until I became a monk, so, you know, 11 or 12 years or something like that. And the other thing that she said was, I was in one of the helping professions, and actually, I think the reason I wound up in the helping professions is because I had actually given up on myself. I didn't know how to help myself. I was absolutely at the end of my rope, but I thought, well, maybe I can help somebody else. And so I kept trying to do that, but I kept kind of leapfrogging over myself, you know what I mean? Just sort of in an effort to help other people. And what she said was, we are in this training for self and other. You know, that was a real eye-opener. We can't leave ourselves out of the equation. And that was the beginning of a lot of teaching that she gave on turning the stream of compassion within. And it really turned around the way that I was working with people, and also in my personal life. She said, you know, we can't really solve other people's problems for them. If you're in the helping profession, this is really a koan. I think I've mentioned to some of you the agency that I was working for, we had a big sign on the wall that said, the helping hand strikes again. So we at least had a clue, maybe, that there was something. But, you know, we really didn't know. I mean, once you know that, but what do you do about it? You know, but she was really quite specific about how to proceed with that. That it wasn't that we needed to help, that we needed to solve people's problems for them, but that we could hold out our faith in them, that they could solve their own. And that was the shift that took place for me in the work that I did. And it was absolutely amazing, because I found myself sitting with people, and I mean literally, just sitting and meditating with people. I didn't put my hands in the meditation posture, but, you know, I just sat with people while they worked out their own problems. And it was amazing to see what people could do and could come up with. Because, you know, really, we're the only ones that know what we need to do. We all know what we need to do. It's just very hard sometimes to kind of get the stuff out of the way so that we can see it and so that we can actually have faith in it. So she was simply passing on the that we could do for others what she was doing for us, which is simply holding out her faith that we had Buddha nature and we have everything that we need, and that we could do that same thing in our relationships with other people. We can do it with our family members, we can do it with people that we are working with. We can just try it and see what happens. One of the teachings that was very much part of this was her teaching on making mistakes. I grew up thinking there was one right way to do something, and my job was to find out what it was. But the thing of it was, you know, it caused a lot of suffering, and what do you know, I never found it. I never really found it. Because actually, of course, there are many, many ways of doing things. And the way that we find out what is good to do is by the practice of the precepts and through our meditation. And that's something that is... So it's constantly changing. It's not just a static thing that you can kind of nail down, get the formula, and then be safe. She said, I can't teach anybody who isn't willing to make mistakes. Now that really turned everything around for me. That we really had to be willing to make mistakes. She said, otherwise you're like a centipede. You're lying on your back. You've got 100 feet. You can't figure out which one to put out first because you don't want to make a mistake. If you've ever seen a poor old centipede stuck on its back, you kind of can get that image. She said, if you actually can take a step, you've got a 50-50 chance of going in the right direction. She said, even if you don't take a step, you're still making karma. You know, no matter what you do, you're going to get the karmic consequences, either of taking action or of not doing anything. So she used to talk about simply being willing to take the next step. You don't have to see too far ahead. Just be willing to take the next step. She tells this great story about how when she was in the Far East, she was a new monk, and her master, Koho Zenji, asked her if she could play chess. Did she know how to play chess? And she said, yeah, I know how to play chess. He said, how many sound moves can you make at one time? She said, oh, I can make 2. He said, oh, I can only make 1. And he put the chess set away. So this teaching of just being willing to take one step. Now, she gave me a very concrete lesson in this once when I was living in Berkeley, and she came down one summer, and I used to go over to the Priory. And she would be down there in the summer because the weather was such up here that it was too hot for her. So she spent about 5 months of the year down in Berkeley and would have some of the monks come down and be there with her. And she was looking for some help in a sewing project. I have really no sewing skills whatsoever, but I thought I could probably run up a seam on the sewing machine, and she really wanted some help, so I very trepidatiously volunteered to help. And she showed me some terry cloth fabric, and she didn't tell me what it was, but she said, "I'll just give you an instruction, and then you can go off and do it and bring it back." So I got started on it, and it went okay for a while, but then at some point I got a little confused, and I really thought, you know, if I just knew what this was, I'd knew how to proceed. But I couldn't ask her. I didn't want to ask her, so I thought, well, I think it's a hmm-hmm. And, you know, if it is, then I would do it this way. So I did it, and I brought it to her, and she said, "No," she said, "but that's not what I asked you to do." And so I went back, and I corrected this, and shortly then someone else came to stay at the Priory, and they actually were able to sew. So they finished this garment. I never knew what it was. But when I thought about this later, I realized that she was both teaching me just to be willing to take one step and to just do it, go off in the unknown, just to have faith. I really didn't need to know what, get the big picture in this case. I just needed to be willing to do that next step. And, you know, it's so often that we're not satisfied with that, you know. If we are wanting, for instance, to work on some habit of our, something that we're having difficulty with, it's so very common to think, gee, I really want to get rid of this, you know. I really want to get rid of my problem with anger. I'll never want to see it again. You know, one-shot deal here, and I want it to go away. She had somebody come up to her after a talk. I think some of you have heard me tell this story because for me it was such a wonderful teaching. Man came up to her after one of her talks and asked her for some help in giving up smoking. I mean, people could just ask her anything. You know, she was willing to help out however she could. He said, "I've tried everything. I want to give it up for the rest of my life. I don't ever want to have a cigarette again," he said, "but everything I've tried has failed." And she just looked at him and she said, "Well, can you go the next 5 minutes without a cigarette?" This is how we have to do it. You don't have to think about giving it up for the rest of your life, because all you've got, really, can you go the next 30 seconds without a cigarette? It's really what it comes down to. I think smokers understand this. But, you know, we've talked about this in terms of taking our vow every morning. We're just taking a vow to keep the precepts for this morning. Can we do it for this day? Or the day ahead? We're not taking the vow to unfold the Buddha's teaching for the rest of our lives. It's just for today. If we do it today, then what we need to do will come out of that. And she had many, many ways of helping us with that teaching over and over again. Now, I think this is particularly helpful for lay training because people often wonder, where are they going to get the time to meditate or do the practice? She talks about the fact in The Goose that She was so busy as the foreign guest master that she actually learned to meditate on the fly, as she put it. So she has complete faith in the ability to meditate throughout the day. Now, a while back, I discovered some notebooks that I had from notes from these early talks. And a lot of it are things that actually she'd written about, you know, that got published in The Roar of the Tigress, because these were the talks, many of them, that she gave in Berkeley. But one of the things I was struck with is in my notes, I wrote down repeatedly that she was emphasizing she said, just do a 30-second meditation. Just stop 30 seconds. And you know, when you see Reverend Master, this is a gesture that is so characteristic of her, right? She's making gassho. And she would say, bring the two halves of your brain together. Even if you can just do it for a second, just do that throughout the day. And if you can't do it physically, just do it mentally. And she would always emphasize, you keep your fingers close together and actually feel your hands. When you do that, it is a very powerful spiritual posture. You know, it's a mudra, actually. And among other things, she said it's a gesture of unity. It cuts through the opposite. Actually, it's amazing how much it cuts through. So this is one of our most powerful tools, and we can use it any time. She used to say to women who said, gee, I've got 5 kids. When can I meditate? She'd say, well, if you got 30 seconds when you wake up in the morning, just sit on the side of your bed. You couldn't get away from it. There was really never any reason not to do it if you wanted to. And if you wanted to, you could find the way to do it in your own life, which would be helpful and meaningful to you. And it was going to be different than the person sitting next to you. Because the part of the practice that resonates for you is going to be what you need in your training. It may or may not be what someone else needs. So for me, the joy and the vitality of training in the world has to do with the fact that it is the seeing the different facets of the jewel being reflected over and over again. Everyone is a different facet. And pomegranates are symbolic in Buddhism, because when you open a pomegranate, it's full of tiny jewels, and they're all separate, and they're all different shapes if you look carefully, and they're all enclosed in the whole. So Reverend Master used to like to use pomegranate juice at various kinds of festivals.